Hi, I'm Illinois Public Media's Lisa Braltz, occasional WILL contributor and permanent space geek. American Experience's Chasing the Moon documentary airs on WILL-TV on July 8th, 9th, and 10th, and is available for streaming in its entirety July 8th. It's 6 glorious hours of space race heaven. The story is told over 3 2-hour installments, beginning with early 20th century rockets, continuing throughout the tumultuous 1960s, and culminating in the first and subsequent moon landings by the United States Apollo program. Apollo was hugely ambitious, and its development took place against a backdrop of incredible cultural and societal growth and upheaval. I talked with University of Illinois history professor David Sepkoski and University of Illinois astronomy professor Joaquin Vieira about the cultural history and happenings that moved us toward Apollo in the 1960s and beyond.
I'm Joaquin Vieira. I'm an associate professor of astronomy and physics here at the University of Illinois.
I'm David Sepkoski. I'm a professor of history at the University of Illinois.
So one of the things I wanted to touch on was Nazi talent, so to speak, in the United States space program. I'm not totally sure that that is something that is really widely known, or certainly wasn't widely known then.
Well, actually, I think it was fairly widely known. From just a cultural standpoint, we can look at the 1965 film Dr. Strangelove, and it was, you know, quite openly known that the character of Dr. Strangelove was kind of an amalgamation of several figures. At any rate, it was the U.S. Army Operation Paperclip that picked up these German scientists and engineers in 1945 after the Germans surrendered was very well known. It was well publicized. They rounded up something like 1,500 or 1,600 of these scientists and engineers. And the media certainly covered this. Von Braun initially led a team of about 130 of these rocket scientists in at the Redstone Arsenal in Alabama, and that actually became the name for the Redstone rocket because they developed that rocket there for ICBM use initially, and it was known, it was written about that von Braun had been. He did not just work for the German military. He was a member of the Nazi Party and, in fact, was later appointed as a colonel in the SS. Von Braun dissembled some about this. There were certainly questions about his past. He may have lied on an official army document about the circumstances and the date when he joined the Nazi Party. There were some outspoken figures. Einstein was one of them who questioned the use of former Nazis in who had contributed directly to the German war effort in the U.S., but ultimately, I guess their usefulness won out against these public objections.
And my understanding is that the Soviet Union also got some Nazis in the deal as well?
Indeed, yeah. There was a race, and this Operation Paperclip was one of several. There was Project Alsos, which went to round up the nuclear scientists, and there was essentially a race from the West and from the East to pick these people up. And there are stories about some of these folks basically seeking out American or Allied soldiers so that they could surrender before the Soviets got there. And the story with von Braun is that von Braun had actually moved from Peenemünde, where in the north, where the V2 operation was set up, down to Austria, and actually von Braun's brother, who was also part of the V2 project, rode his bike out and found a U.S. Army soldier, a private, and said, "My brother invented the U-2, the V-2. Excuse me. We'd like to surrender." And so that's how they ended up on the American side. But you're absolutely right. The Soviets had a number of. They actually had, in some ways, they had better technology. They were actually able to recover more of the V-2 rockets themselves to study them.
So you mentioned that Einstein had some objections, and there were probably others, I imagine, who had objections. I'm just curious how you think in today's cancel culture, how something like that would fly now.
Cancel culture? What's that?
Cancel culture is like, you know, somebody misbehaves and that's it. They're over. They're done. You can't. They're totally canceled. Came up. I think it's a. It's like a.
Like how we can't watch the Cosby Show anymore.
Sort of like that. That's that people have been canceled, and some people have been canceled for like big wrongdoings,
like
and other people have been canceled for far less than that. And so I'm curious. Yeah. Because you're saying that the media covered it and people were talking about it, I feel like there's a pretty serious gap in my knowledge. I was not aware of that.
Right.
You know, it was sort of glossed over, I think, maybe when I was growing up. So maybe 70s, 80s, 90s, not so much of a thing. But I'm curious now in this age of social media and people, you know, coming to very quick conclusions about how they're going to react to something, how something like this would fly.
Well, so as I understand from the history, so didn't paperclips, it started before surrender, right?
They created a list. Yeah. So, I mean, all of these projects had lists. You're right. And the moment that they could, you know, and they basically followed. I mean, ALSO's in some cases was even ahead of the advance trying to pick these people up. So you're absolutely right. It was something that was going on, you know, as the final push towards Berlin was taking place.
Yeah. And then to your point of, you know, did the public know? I mean, remember NASA had PR photos with the team, like the leaders. Mm-hmm. And so von Braun's there.
Yep.
As I understand, there was an effort to kind of, is whitewash the right word, is Nazism, you know, they always, this was always whitewashed. I think even today there's questions about it. And usually now it's explained as well. Yeah, he was in the Nazi party, but he wasn't enthusiastic.
I just think it's interesting that perhaps it was seen as like one of the spoils of war, I guess, you know, war's over and we're going to divvy up the talent. And it was the Nazis and they were the bad guys, but now they're the good guys because they're with us.
Well, and to your question about cancel culture, I think one difference is that, I mean, this was known from the very beginning. So this wasn't a revelation that, you know, that came out later about somebody's past. And, you know, von Braun did demonstrate remorse and attempt to kind of rehabilitate his image. One of the things about von Braun is that he converted to evangelical Christianity not that long after. He had been a Lutheran, but a sort of lapsed Lutheran in Germany, converted to evangelical Christianity, adopted a very kind of pious attitude and claimed, and there's this sort of famous quotation, I don't have it written down, so I can only paraphrase it, that he believed that this technology should only be in the hands of people who follow the Bible. Apparently, that's meaning the U.S. And he claimed that, you know, I mean, essentially it's, you know, the same argument that atomic scientists made too. If the genie's out of the bottle, it has to be in responsible hands. I will note that for the first almost 10 years that von Braun was in the country, he was pretty marginalized. He was not given much freedom. I mean, personal freedom. Those Operation Paperclip people were kind of kept under a tight leash in Alabama. And it was really only once the Mercury Project got underway that he actually began to achieve prominence. He chafed while the Soviets were making advances and launching Sputnik, that none of his new rocket designs were being considered. So he really wasn't, I mean, he didn't become a star until the space program, you know, really got its kind of formal. I mean, really right around, you know, the early 1960s is when his star really ascended. Prior to that, yeah, he was kind of like a spoil of war that you capture and then put on a shelf somewhere more to make sure they don't get into somebody else's hands. And then by the time, you know, by the time Kennedy makes his announcement in 1961, you know, we're now more than 15 years past the war. And I think maybe, you know, people felt like enough time had passed or something like that.
One thing I just remember reading about the early or that history of them, it seemed very ambiguous for me reading it. Were they prisoners? Because they were on a military base.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really clear how much free choice they had in this. And, you know, I mean, I think at some level it was like, well, you can stay here and be under the Soviet rule and like think what they're going to do. They're not going to give you the choice. But it was interesting, you know, and then they go and they're basically sequestered on a military base.
Yeah. They referred to themselves as prisoners of peace.
Yeah.
Kind of half, only half jokingly.
Yeah. And you brought up, the spoils of war. And I think that was, that's a really good analogy. And the technology really was the spoil here. And I mean, I think, you know, defining feature, I think in world history about World War II was that I'm a physicist and, you know, it was really the technology of physics that won that war. And if you think about World War I, you know, it was chemistry, it was gas and so forth, and then eventually it was like tanks and stuff. But in World War II, the defining technologies that really gave us the edge, it was radar, which is physics, and it was the nuclear bomb. And everybody knew that the kind of next thing was this was going to be rockets, and it was because how do you now have a bomb? How are you going to transport it? And so I do think, you know, people recognize that, and you know that the fact that the technology of physics won the war was a big reason why physics was so well funded in the 50s, 60s, and you know, up until basically Apollo, and then it fell off a cliff. But you know, people recognize that, or important politicians and military industrial leaders recognize that.
Maybe we can talk about that a little bit, about the public support, or
let's go into that.
Yeah.
I mean the fact of the matter is the American people in opinion poll after opinion poll from the late 1950s up until the early 1970s fairly decisively voiced their opposition to at least the amounts of money that were being spent on it. I think there was only one public opinion poll, and that was taken right after the Apollo 11 landing, that rose above 50% in terms of people saying, is it worth spending the money that we've been spending on this project? And there's kind of a mythology, and there's some good scholarship out there and some good articles out there showing that, including one by NASA's former NASA chief historian, that that this was something that was wildly popular with the public. You had maybe only 15% of Americans thought more money ought to be spent on the space program. Most Americans felt that less money should be spent, or that the budgets shouldn't be increased.
It reminds me a little bit of World War II. I think there's revisionist history that happens where we grew up thinking that everybody was all about getting into World War II and really socking it to the Nazis and the Japanese, when actually there were a lot of people who were very against going to war and preferred that America take a much more isolationist sort of stance there. And I think it's kind of the same with the space program, like finding out much later on for me that I just thought everybody wanted to go up into space and that it was the super popular thing, right, and that everybody was really excited to go. And as it turns out, there were a lot of people who asked a lot of questions. And it wasn't just about money. It was also about spending that money in other places domestically, yeah, right? So like
absolutely,
that there's money that could be better spent, not just on the science and technology of this, quote, fantasy of sending somebody to the moon, but also, you know, there are a lot of other things going on in the 60s that probably could have used.
And I think it's so concisely said in Gil Scott Heron's Whitey on the Moon, right?
Yeah. Where a rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the Moon.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the Moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know, the man just up my...
So I was actually surprised when Curiosity rover, mm-hmm, when that landed, mm-hmm, and people were, and you know, as a geek, I was half intrigued. You know, I don't know. I was only kind of half intrigued. Like, yeah, we're sending another little rover.
Yeah.
But I thought there was actually, I was surprised by the amount of excitement in the public over that. It surprised me.
Well, Mars is a singular, I think, object, you know, of imagination. And I mean, in here we could maybe sort of segue a little bit into talking about the science fiction aspect and, mm-hmm, and the sort of imagination aspect of thing.
What year was Curiosity? When was that? I'm looking it up right now, but
12.
Okay.
12.
So you also have, like, people were totally jazzed about it because of social media. You can see these images right away.
Right.
People are talking about them. You have, wasn't that Adam Selzner or whatever his name is? He's kind of like this rockabilly looking astronomer,
right,
or physicist, designer, engineer guy.
Yeah.
And the dude with the mohawk at NASA, like all of a sudden, like,
it was dramatic. There's this landing.
Well,
and,
that's,
it
was dramatic because you had the videos, like, sort of showing you how it was going to deploy if it didn't like burn up in the atmosphere, because like there's been a lot of Mars fails too, right? So people are kind of watching for that. So I've found with certain things, in space, whether it's Curiosity or landing on an asteroid or, you know, other things that people, black hole photo, people get really pumped because they're seeing it. The news being delivered in real time, and they're seeing it. Yeah, exactly. And they're seeing the people who are doing it. It's not just a bunch of squares and ties and pocket protectors. There are people who look like them. Like, the, I think the NASA's more diverse. I think there's, I mean, it's got a long way to go, but it's happening. And I think that's part of it, too. That's part of the excitement.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, think about, comparatively speaking, how little there was for people to see in the 1960s. I mean, of course, the famous Earthrise photograph from, what was that? That was Apollo
68.
That was Apollo 8. Yeah. Apollo 8. You know, that became iconic. Of course, there were the images of Armstrong and the other astronauts as they, you know, as they got off of the lander. But for the most part, what people were crowding around and watching was, you know, newscasters and maybe some what would seem to us fairly rudimentary graphics showing where they thought various, you know, where they thought the capsule was and where the orbiter was and things like that. So I think that actually part of the excitement about space exploration now really is very image based, right? It's because we can see, you know, we can see in you know, 4K detail the landscape of Mars or new pictures of, you know, Saturn's rings or something like that. So it's sort of an appropriate, in a way, fascination for the 21st century because information is so much cheaper and easier to transfer, and we can more viscerally experience it in that way. But we're missing the human excitement, you know, the human element part of the story.
As in humans
Exactly. It lacks the human drama.
Well, and that's why I think a film like The Martian resonated with a lot of people, too, because it's like near future seems possible and plausible, right? And that's why people really like that story.
I mean, I think one of the important points to make is that almost everybody involved in the development of manned space flight was a science fiction fan. Von Braun was, you know, read not just science fiction, but early German speculations about the future of space travel and exploration in the 1920s and 1930s. Robert Goddard, who developed, you know, the first really workable rocket technology, which I'm sure you've talked about in another conversation, was inspired by H.G. Wells and Jules Verne. But it was a very romantic image of space travel and exploration, one that assumed that human beings would be occupying, you know, the solar system at least, if not themselves traveling to distant stars. So I think one thing that's kind of interesting, kind of funny, is that despite the enormous technical achievement that the moon landing undoubtedly was, it also fell way, way short of what many of these, you know, visionaries' dreams were. I mean, Goddard thought he actually might, you know, he might possibly be able to send a moon mission himself. You know, I mean, he quickly realized that was wildly improbable. Von Braun definitely wanted to have, you know, colonies on the moon, colonies on Mars, and things like that, because that's really what that was the romantic image that the science fiction was presenting. But the science fiction also reinforced and reflected technical developments at the time as well. So you have authors like Arthur C. Clarke and Isaac Asimov, who were not only writing, you know, fictional stories about space travel and the future and aliens and things like that, but who are also very involved in various, you know, societies for the promotion of space exploration. And, you know, in the case of Clarke, who were, you know, actually fairly well respected in the scientific community and reflected the state of the art in science in their science fiction as well, which itself then often inspired ideas for new directions in the science.
And in terms of the optimism of those early rocketeers, it was amazing. You know, they weren't just talking about getting to the moon. I mean, we're thinking about this. They were talking about exploring the stars, right? Which nowadays we would think of just absolutely laughable. You know, sorry kids, but you're never going to see an astronaut go to another star ever in your lifetime.
It's interesting. I would be interested to know, and Joaquin, maybe you know from the perspective of astronomy, at what point it became fairly definitively clear that the solar system was lifeless, at least from the perspective of, large multicellular organisms, or that it was unlikely to inhabit, anything remotely like intelligent life or life on Earth.
I would say, it became pretty clear once we had telescopes that, say, Mars didn't have an atmosphere, right? Mm-hmm. And you could kind of look at it and tell once you could just kind of look at it from here and tell that.
By telescopes, you mean telescopes of a certain power,
yeah.
Right? Because obviously we have had telescopes.
Yeah. So remember basically at the turn of the last century, there was still a debate over
the canals.
Yeah. And so forth. And nobody really thought that. But at the same time, that's not to say, the scale that they were resolving, those would be like mountain ranges. Well, could you have actually seen smaller features? No. But they would have known there's no atmosphere, for instance, or no real thick atmosphere. But around the outer planets, it's
sure.
Totally open. I think by the time, though, we had real advanced technology, like post-World War II, it would have been obvious that there was no radio communication.
Yeah.
They weren't coming here, so they weren't more advanced than us. So it would have been obvious to most scientists by post-war, that...
But Star Trek came up in 1966, so this is like sort of after the fact, and we're still not yet at the moon, but it's pretty clear that we're probably going up there to mine a bunch of rocks and then come back, right?
I think that raises a really interesting point. I think you're right that it was a way of kind of projecting our ambitions further in an imaginative sense. But there's another aspect of Star Trek that I think reflects maybe the way that the romantic vision of space travel shifted, in that, in Star Trek and in other fictional depictions of space travel at the time, the utopian vision was really about ennobling the human species through space travel. And that was reflected actually in the actual political visions, both in the US and in the Soviet Union, at least in from a kind of a propaganda sense. The Soviets saw this as a kind of grand expression of socialist values, and that, we would eventually colonize the solar system and by getting off of the Earth, we would transcend some of the pettiness and, viciousness of our species here. So in a way, I think that there was a way for the romantic vision to kind of transform, and less one in that was dependent on contact with, fantastical aliens, and more one that saw leaving Earth as a kind of a graduation. And, this is reflected in the famous novel by Arthur C. Clarke, Childhood's End. And that really, I think, underwrote a lot of what the vision of 2001, A Space Odyssey, was as well. I mean, there certainly is an encounter with an alien intelligence, but you never see aliens. It's about the expansion of kind of the human possibilities. And yeah. That you can see that directly in, what Kennedy was talking about when he called for the mission to the moon.
I think another thing that changed, right, is the old stuff like H.G. Wells, right? It was, how does civilization die? Well, it's like, aliens from out there come and destroy us. And after World War II is kind of always human self-annihilation, yeah. Right?
That's like right.
Doomsday stuff.
No, that's right for the most part. I mean, there's a pretty significant literature about things like plagues wiping yeah. out humans before, that exist before the Second World War. But no, absolutely. The Second World War is a huge turning point, and the focus really becomes much darker too.
Yeah.
And science fiction actually in the 60s takes on much more mature themes. You have authors like Frank Herbert, Samuel Delaney, who are writing who are writing fiction that sometimes even Robert Heinlein begins to, who had, you know, begun as a pulp writer, explore, you know, sexual themes, darker kinds of psychological themes. And that ultimately, I think, creates an interest in an appetite for science fiction that is a bit of a link between the space program and the counterculture at the time. I mean, you might think that these things were kind of opposed. I mean, in many ways, right? The astronauts were described by Pauline Kael once as walking apple pies, I think, right? they were presented in such a squeaky clean.
Oh, I mean, Life magazine totally did that to them. Yeah.
Well, but they are so establishment. I mean, they were all military people with immaculate records, right? College degrees, engineering, pilots. I mean, these were highly trained, highly accomplished people within the military industrial complex.
Yes, but.
But they were presented like plastic people. So here's, this is a great quotation from actually David Bowie. And he's reflecting on why he wrote Space Oddity, which for people who don't know, is the song that begins Ground Control to Major Tom, which was actually released in July of 1969, just 5 days before the Apollo 11 launch. And he later said that he developed the song as a kind of rejection of the sterile, almost robotic character that was being projected onto, you know, space exploration, onto the astronauts at the time. And this is a quote, "The publicity image of a spaceman at work is of an automaton rather than a human being. And my Major Tom is nothing if not a human being. It came from a feeling of sadness about this aspect of the space thing to try and relate science and human emotion. I suppose it's an antidote to space fever, really.
Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. 10. Ground control 9. To Major Tom.
7. 6.
Commencing 5. Countdown engines on.
3. 2.
Check ignition
1.
And may God's love
lift
be
off.
With you. This is Ground Control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade, and the papers want to know whose shirts you wear.
Well, right. And actually, Space Oddity was played during the coverage of the moonshot by the BBC. Apparently, nobody listened to the lyrics beforehand because actually then it was actually kept off of the airwaves until the astronauts returned because, you know, if you know the song, it doesn't go well. It's unclear what happens exactly. That gets resolved by what's
distortion.
The follow-up. But Bowie went on to say, and this is another quote, "I want it to be the first anthem of the moon," right? So there was a sense in which popular culture, the counterculture, not just the kind of Leave It to Beaver watching, you know, a nuclear family gathering, you know, public appreciated and took on the sort of the legacy of the space program, but it was a more psychedelic. I mean, there was, you know, early Pink Floyd was you know, really kind of, you know, bound up in science fiction and the space, you know, and the space program, the Birds. So the kind of psychedelic 70s, right, which were different from the psychedelic late 60s, that interest in fantasy and science fiction and all, I think is a product to some degree of the space program, but it's one that you view through the music and movies like 2001 rather than necessarily through the actual events of, you know, the moon landing itself.
I mean, I'm going to make a broad swath of a statement, but would you say that the moon landing was the last thing that humans, that American citizens were more or less unanimously proud of their country for? I mean, if you think about, you know, historically, you know, what since then, what Iraq, you know, like people are not proud about,
right?
You know,
yeah. Well, I mean, so one sort of, and this is very simplistic, but one kind of narrative about late 20th century American history is that, you know, the Vietnam War was a kind of, it was a moment in history. I don't know if you want to call it a sort of like coming of age or waking up or something like that. I mean, it certainly was a bucket of cold water on the triumphant narrative of American exceptionalism. Yeah. And so, you know, I would, you know, independent of the space program, I don't know what things would look like, but I mean, the Vietnam War is really the signal event that you know that happens at that time and that really shifts things.
Well, it comes to this huge head. We had been involved for years, right. But it really just starts ramping up right around the same time that the space program is ramping up, and you have two aspects of the military being shown during the 60s too. You have the space program and the guys who are going to the moon who are all military, and then you have all these grunts going over to Vietnam and losing their lives. And it seemed to me in a lot of ways that the idea of losing astronaut lives was more unthinkable to people than the lives that were being lost in Vietnam every day.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They would have thought of it as, I mean,
or in riots, you know, like like in America that were happening.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they would have. I mean, the Apollo 1 disaster was like a national tragedy, and they did everything they could to ensure that that didn't happen again. These were American heroes, and it was public.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I know we probably don't have a whole lot of time left, but I mean, I wonder if we want to talk a little bit about what's maybe some of the cultural legacy or impacts.
Absolutely.
Of,
yeah.
or historical legacy or impacts. I mean, that I just go back to that famous Earthrise picture. I mean, it's been argued that basically signaled the rise of the environmental movement as it, you know, as it became like kind of a supercharged political movement. I mean, you have the passage of the Endangered Species Act in the United States just, I think, 3 years later. This is not long after Rachel Carson has published Silent Spring. And it became a galvanizing image, the notion of spaceship Earth, which was actually, I think, a phrase that had been used a number of times before, but I think most famously by Buckminster Fuller, as a way of thinking about the fragility of our planet, right? So that the perspective that the space program gave us and that these images gave us was not just one of human triumph and superiority, but rather a recognition also of the fragility and vulnerability of the planet. And if nothing else, I mean, I would say, I mean, it didn't produce colonies on the moon or missions to Mars or anything like that, but it gave us a new sense of or a new perspective on humans' place, you know, on what our home, the Earth, is, and on humans' place in, you know, this kind of vast cosmos that was tangible and that people could look at and point to. And so I think that's another way in which the space program actually really did contribute to a sort of countercultural or protest-oriented segment of society, if not directly in the way it was intended.
For sure. And then Carl Sagan takes it into the early 80s with, you know, Pale Blue Dot and Cosmos and all of that.
Right.
And I think he really, at least for me, I remember my dad making me watch it on TV with him when it was airing originally. And I think he really did a lot to bring that countercultural, you know, early 70s, late 60s, early 70s kind of vibe into the 80s and remind people about that. And then, of course, the imagery is so much better from all the other work that is going on out in space. And he strikes me as sort of one of those legacy types.
Well, and prior to the early 1970s, you don't really have scientists who are public figures and public intellectuals the way they became after that. I mean, you had famous scientists like Einstein, and you certainly, I mean, you had the, you know, you had the superstars, but, you know, yes, Carl Sagan is someone who came into people's living rooms every night and people actually tuned in to watch. Yeah. And so, I mean, in a way that moves all the way up to, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who I guess is actually part of cancel culture a little bit right now, but, you know, and others. I mean, I do think that the space program probably did have a role, probably connected also to the atomic bomb program, because Robert Oppenheimer and others, you know, sort of drew public attention. But in creating a public interest and appetite for science and for scientists and their perspectives. I mean, Joaquin, you asked when was the last time that the Americans were unanimously, you know, proud of something. But when before that, can you recall Americans so unanimously or in such large numbers being interested in, you know, in a scientific event of some kind? And after that, we've only had, you know, it is now a significant part of our media culture, involves interest in science, interest in what scientists have to say.
Public Media. I'm Lisa Braltz.